Good morning. We will bring the April 20th, 2022 Board of Directors meeting of the Eastern Municipal Water District to order. Director Corona, would you like to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance this morning?
This flag. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Can I ask the Board Secretary if she would read the rules for our virtual meetings and do a board roll call, please?
Sure. We'll start off with roll call. Director Record?
Here.
Director Corona?
Here.
Director Slauson? Director Armstrong?
Here.
And our legal counsel is here, as well as President Pauly. I am going to review the guidelines for virtual participation in EMWD board meetings. To avoid creating acoustic feedback, please mute all your devices during the meeting unless you are speaking. Before speaking, please unmute your device and turn down the volume of any other devices that are near you and tuned into the meeting. If you have joined by phone and would like to comment on an item, please press star 9 to let our staff know and wait to be notified. When it is your turn to speak, you will hear a notification asking you to unmute your phone by pressing star 6. If you have joined by computer, you may use the chat feature in Zoom to indicate your desire to speak. When done speaking, please mute your device again. Please participate from a quiet environment so that the board can hear you when you are speaking.
Thank you so much. April, do we have any members of the public that have requested to do public comment this morning?
I don't have any requests at this time.
Very good. With that, we will move on to item 2, which is our general manager's report. Mr. Mawad.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. My report is included in your packet. I wanted to share with you some highlights from that report. Under new and ongoing items, as you may be aware, on April 12th, after several budget workshops chaired by Director Record, as well as significant feedback from member agencies, the Metropolitan Water District Board of Directors approved their biennium budget and rate increases. Specifically, they approved a $1.9 million budget for fiscal year 2022-23 and a $2 billion budget for fiscal year 23-24. Associated with that budget is a 5.0% rate increase for each year. I should mention it was a unanimous vote in support of the rate increase and the budget. Having said that, to keep the increases at the forecasted 5.0%, it was decided that the budget will include approximately $53 million in reductions, specifically from the operations budget. There's also other areas that Metropolitan decided to reduce. They've also budgeted based on a labor vacancy rate of 5.0%. Currently, their vacancy is around 10% of their labor force. They also incorporated other steps to reduce the overall budget and obviously to minimize the rate increases. They are projecting that after this biennium period that the rate increases in the subsequent year 2025 will be 7%. And beyond that, between the years 26 and 29, it would be approximately 6%. We looked at the budget very closely. Obviously, we worked closely with Director Record, Jolene, myself, Laura, John, all of us were very much engaged in the process with Director Record. We've also looked at the financial impact of this rate increase. The rate increase in itself is 5%, but when you look closely at the readiness to serve charge as well as the capacity charges, there are some differences from the prior rate increases. The impact on EMWD for our current biennium budget is approximately $400,000 in next year's budget, so we are planning to obviously use operations reserve to address that. Beyond that, for 2024, we're working with our finance team. We're currently in the process of developing a cost of service study, and we'll incorporate the approved budget from MET as part of that effort. The next item I want to share with you is on the heels of securing 2022 earmark funding for Arquail Valley project as well as Mead Valley Booster. Staff is already engaged in pursuing 2023 earmark funding, and we've engaged with all of our elected delegation, and we've submitted requests for project funding considerations, including projects in Congressman Takano's area to fund Well 56 PFAS remediation. With Congressman Calvert, we are submitting an application as well to continue with additional phases of the Quail Valley septic to sewer conversion. For Congressman Issa, we've had conversations with his office about funding the Wine Country infrastructure sewer project. And we also have submitted for Congressman Ruiz's consideration funding of Well 27. In addition to the applications that we submitted recently, myself as well as staff have held meetings with each of the congressman's staff, and we are explaining the benefits and the value of each one of those projects. So we'll keep the board up to date as this process advances. Next item, I wanted to let you know that recently we've held conversations and discussions with the Saboba tribe. They are looking at expanding development on their tribal lands, as well as converting residential units from septic to sewer. As you know, we currently serve the Saboba tribe's tribal lands, and as such, they are looking for expanded capacity in the collection and conveyance system. It was a really fruitful conversation. They intend to pursue federal and state funding that has been set aside for tribes, and we offer to assist them in that pursuit of funding. And so we are looking at a number of opportunities to work with them, including their interest in receiving recycled water for their golf course and potentially decommissioning their current groundwater well, which obviously would be a benefit to the entire participants of the Water Master. So there's a number of opportunities we're exploring with them. I think it was a very fruitful conversation. And we are also going to be funding and advancing a joint study to look at the sewering options and requirements. And staff is working with Saboba to develop and finalize the scope of work. We anticipate to bring that before you in June for your consideration and approval of that effort. Next, I wanted to share some good news. I'm pleased to report that we are in the final stages of completing the Paris 2 desalter. In fact, this week, we've been undergoing functional testing and startup testing, and we anticipate that next week we will be able to commence our 21-day performance testing at full capacity of the desalter. So it's an important milestone after 3 years of construction at the site. With the start of the 21-day performance testing, that will satisfy our local resource program requirement with the Metropolitan Water District. So obviously we'll be notifying them accordingly once we have completed that. Also, I'm going to be working closely with the Public Governmental Affairs, with April and the board, and we're going to start looking at a dedication event to be held. We'll probably look at sometime in mid to late June before it gets too hot out there, but we'll keep you aware of that. Under items of interest of the board, I wanted to share with you that yesterday Linnea and I had a really good conversation with the South Coast Water District regarding their Doheny Beach desal proposed project. It was a really good conversation with their general manager and their chief engineer, and we discussed a number of things, including where are they at with the process of identifying partners for that desal plan. As you know, South Coast needs 2 MGD out of the 5 MGD plan. They have been in conversations with the city of San Clemente, with Laguna Beach, as well as Molten Niguel, and other South Coast Orange County agencies that could benefit from that local resource. We discussed the framework that they are seeking. They did share with us late yesterday a template letter of intent that we are going to review to understand better what would be a possible path forward in continuing the conversations with the South Coast. They also have engaged with Metropolitan, and their Metropolitan's general manager visited the district, and Metropolitan is also looking at the opportunities for Metropolitan's participation. They are planning to seek LRP funding from MET. In fact, they are just waiting to clear their permit, and they plan to submit that application to MET possibly later this year for MET's consideration and approval. Our discussions are also going to expand to Metropolitan, because we need to understand if we were to consider participation in this ocean desal facility, would we receive the designation of extraordinary supply, meaning would Matt consider this a local supply versus an import supply? So those conversations are going to be held with Metropolitan as well as with South Coast. As we gather more information, Linnea and I will bring this item back to the Operations and Engineering Committee for additional discussion. Finally, I wanted to share with the board that we are monitoring an assembly bill up in Sacramento. This is Assembly Bill 2932 that has proposed to reduce the standard work week to 32 hours versus the standard 40 hours, essentially any hours beyond the 32. And this is for employers that have 500 employees or more. Anything above 32 hours would be a time and a half of the standard employee rate. We've looked at it. We've monitored it. Currently, that bill resides in the Assembly Committee on Labor and Employment, where it is yet to be set for a hearing. We don't believe it's going to advance. It appears unlikely. Having said that, the bill, 2932, is similar to a federal bill that Congressman Takano introduced in the House, H.R. 4728, which also proposed a 32-hour work week and would make similar changes to the Fair Labor Standards Act. The bill that Congressman Takano has introduced has not yet gained momentum either. So we'll continue monitoring those bills and let you know if there's any movement on that front. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions that the board may have.
Couple of comments, actually. I really appreciate staff's help on the budget process at Met. That was very grueling, and frankly, I'm a little disappointed that we landed on that increase because I don't think it covers our costs going forward, and I think there's going to be a lot more pain to come. And related to the Doheny Ocean Desal and local project funding, we're not funding local projects now, and we have to have some sort of moratorium or I don't know what until we figure out a way to fund it. So I would be surprised, just kind of a heads up, I'd be surprised if any new project applications are accepted or even dealt with. So hopefully we deal with that sooner than later.
Now, that's a great point, Dr. Rucker. In fact, we shared our same thought with South Coast yesterday. We said, I don't know if you're aware of the dynamic and the conversation being held at Met regarding the overall LRP program, but you should be aware that we're not certain that's going to be available potentially. As you know, the budget that was just approved did not include any new commitments of LRP funding. It's just meeting the existing commitments. So South Coast, based on the current schedule, they are planning to advance the project through a progressive design build, but ultimately they're thinking they could have it online as early as 2026. So that's when potentially, if they're able, if there is LRP funding, that's when they would start receiving that funding. But to your point, it has to go to the Met Board this year for consideration. And I think that question to the Met Board is going to have to be addressed sooner than later.
Right. Any other questions for Joe?
Director Armstrong?
Yeah, I was going to congratulate Director Rucker on the effort at Met with the rate increase, and I know it's challenging, and it looks like there's going to be more pressure going forward. But you never know in the future what happens. Maybe there'll be something good that will moderate that pressure. And
appreciate that, Jeff.
Yeah, and then to the South Coast Water and the desal, just think it's great that you're engaged, and I think that's what's important is that we stay engaged in it and follow it and keep evaluating as it moves forward to see if it's something that would work for us and make sense for us. So I think it's great that you guys are having those conversations.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Laura, do you have something for us this morning?
Yes, I do. Good morning, President Pauley and members of the board. I'm pleased to introduce our new Director of Human Resources, Joe Opress. So if you could stand, Joe. Joe has more than a decade of experience in the human resources field, and more recently he served as Human Resources Director for the San Bernardino Community College District, which has approximately 2,000 employees and serves about 20,000 students. Prior to being promoted to the director, he did serve as human resources manager and also employee relations officer at the district. Joe obtained his Bachelor of Science and Master's degree at Cal Baptist University. I performed a lot of background interviews, and colleagues shared that Joe is extremely well-regarded and known for being a collaborative, engaged leader with a reputation of working well with all members of the organization of which he served. He brings considerable knowledge and experience in all facets of human resources, including recruitment, retention, employee and labor relations, employee benefits, compensation, training and development, and human resources information systems. Joe is passionate about human resources and enjoys being part of a team that strives to provide excellent services to employees. So I'm going to bring Joe up to say a few words.
Good morning, Board, and thank you for having me. I appreciate the introduction as well. Thank you very much. Excited to be part of the team and to help the district move forward. So thank you very much.
Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
I think you're gonna find that here at Eastern, we take the HR position very seriously. I think we love to recruit and retain, with the emphasis on retain, the best talent in the area. And so you have some big shoes to fill, but I look forward to working with you. So thank you for joining us this morning. All right, thank you, Lauren. Nick, do you have anything
Nothing
for us
today.
This morning?
Good morning, President Pauly and members of the board. This morning, Danielle Coates is participating in a State Water Resource Control Board workshop where the State Board is hearing staff's proposal for how to allocate $350 million from the groundwater and recycled water projects program. And she will be advocating on EMWD's behalf for additional funding for our Paris North program.
Very good. Matt?
Good morning. As it relates to our purified water replenishment project that we've embarked on, you might recall we recently completed a pilot study where we looked at using closed circuit RO to treat the recycled water as part of that process. And so district staff submitted that pilot project to AQUA for the Innovation Award, and we were selected as one of the finalists for that project, so that was great. I'll be at AQUA at the conference to participate on the panel, and hopefully we win.
Hopefully. So. Very good. Any questions for any other of the executive staff? Very good. With that, we'll move to item 3 on our agenda, which is our consent calendar. Do any members of the board wish to pull an item for further discussion or separate vote? Seeing none, I'll take a motion by Director Corona. Second by Director Slauson. May I get a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Record?
I'll vote aye, but I would like to be shown as on approval of the minutes for April 6th and abstain because I wasn't at that meeting.
Okay. Director Cronin?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
And that passes 5-0 except for item A, which passes 4-0 with Director Record abstaining. Now go to item 4 on the agenda, which is our action calendar. Item 4A is to adopt a proposed resolution of the Board of Directors of the Eastern Municipal Water District authorizing the renewal of a standby bond purchase agreement with Bank of America supporting refunding water wastewater revenue bonds, Series 201A, and approved financing documents. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. This past January, the board was presented the annual plan of finance, which included highlights from 2021, summary of the district's debt portfolio, and the plan of finance for 2022. No new money needs were identified or communicated to the board, but there was one market access event related to the 2018A bonds and the expiring standby bond purchase agreement. The item today summarizes the collaboration with the district staff and PFM, the district's financial advisor, and culminates in a recommendation to extend the standby bond purchase agreement with Bank of America. Darren Hodge is on the call today. He was unable to attend in person, but he will be available and happy to answer any questions, should there be any. Before jumping into the standby bond purchase agreement, I figured give a brief update on the market given the current climate. Directing your attention to the graph on the right, tax exempt rates basically started the year relatively at the same place where they hovered in 2021, though in recent months have experienced some volatility and some upward pressure. As the market has dealt with inflation concerns, Federal Reserve announcements or indications for rate hikes, as well as a conflict in Ukraine. When we look at the current rates and compare them to rates over the last 20 years, which is on the graph on the left, we see that rates are still relatively low compared to where they've been over the last two decades. Moving on to variable rates, on the right you see variable rates are very low and have remained low over the last 12 months, though in the last few months have also experienced some volatility, but not to the degree of fixed rates shown on the previous slide. I will point out on when we zoom out for the same period since 2000, we see considerable volatility, certain points in the graph on the left, though current rates are very low and near all-time lows when we look at rates compared to rates over the last 2 years. The 2018 A bonds are variable rate debt that's reset on a daily basis by Citigroup. The standby bond purchase agreement is with Bank of America, and essentially it provides a liquidity facility in case there were any issues with the remarketing of the bonds. There hasn't been any. There aren't any expected, especially with a AAA credit of EMWD. But should there be any, the standby bond purchase agreement with Bank of America would essentially purchase the bonds, and that way they got sold. Or that way they would be sold and continue to reset. The graph on this slide shows the financial performance, if you will, over the last 3.5 years since the 2018 A's were issued back in October of 2018. As you could see, the average all-in cost is just about 1%. There was some volatility when COVID kind of hit the financial markets in March of 2020. But following that, the rates stabilized, and we've been under the average since then. Even with some volatility in the last couple months, rates are still resetting very low. Now, the standby bond purchase agreement expires in September of this year, but can be renewed or replaced at any time. And so over the last couple months, the district worked with PFM to analyze the various options and look at what options were available to the district. Now, some of those options include renewing or replacing the standby bond purchase agreement. They also included fixing out the debt, as well as refunding the debt with other variable rate debt. We looked at several factors, including the current market, forecasted future rates in the market, overall net cost of the district, and the district's future liquidity and financing needs. Conservative assumptions were made, and the costs of the district were annualized for each available option. In order to account for the rising interest rate environment that we are currently just starting, the last period of interest rate hikes by the Federal Reserve from 2015 to 2018 was analyzed, and rates were used to project an index adjustment for this analysis to keep this analysis and future costs relative. The table on this slide summarizes the all-in costs for each approach, including the cost of issuance. with approximately $95 million outstanding, on the 2018 A bonds, the current agreement or extending the current agreement really results in the lowest net cost of the district at an all-in cost of 1.045%. With $95 million outstanding, this amounts to about $980,000. In contrast, when we looked at the cost to fix out this debt, the all-in cost was 3.64%, which would amount to about $3.4 million, the difference being about $2.4 million. Over the last couple years, as rates have been near historic lows, the district has strategically taken advantage of fixing out variable rate debt and also freeing up capacity for maintaining some variable rate debt or even pursuing issuance of variable rate debt during a rising interest rate environment. Now that we're seeing some volatility in the market, interest rates increasing, maintaining this as variable rate debt at a healthy basis essentially brings the lowest cost to the district and adds the most flexibility. In summary, extending the agreement with Bank of America, as I mentioned, is the lowest cost of the district. Bank of America has agreed to lower the agreement or the fee by 8 basis points, which is about 23% reduction. And maintaining a component of variable rate debt in the district's debt portfolio also adds as a natural hedge against interest earnings in our investment portfolio. And it also will free up some flexibility in 3 years when when this agreement would expire in 2025 to consolidate other callable debt that the district has in 2025 and potentially bring those together for a more sizable issuance, achieve some economies of scale, savings with cost of issuance, and achieving an even better interest rate at that point. Staff's recommendation is to extend the agreement with Bank of America, also approve the agreement and the fee letter, and then also authorize the district's executive team to execute and deliver the documents necessary to renew this agreement. Be happy to answer any questions, and as I mentioned, Darren Hodge from PFM is also on the call.
Director Slauson.
Yes, if you could, just for clarification, how does the standby purchase agreement work? We're paying, it's almost like an insurance policy.
In a way, yes. I'm going to go back to this graph. As we see on the colored slide, in the colors, these are all the costs that are associated to the 2018 A's, basically costs going forward. The dark blue is the reset of the interest rate that we pay for that variable rate. The light blue is the standby bond purchase agreement, the 35 basis points currently being reduced moving forward. And then green, which is hard to see, is the remarketing. So we pay Citigroup to remarket the bonds. We pay them 7 basis points. But then, as you mentioned, Director Slauson, the insurance, or somewhat of an insurance, if the bonds fail to be remarketed or if there is so much volatility in the market that they go unsold, the standby bond purchase agreement, that liquidity that we have locked in, more like a line of, like a letter of credit, basically, would step in, purchase those bonds, and we pay essentially a service fee to have use of that facility, which was 35 basis points and now being reduced.
So then Bank of America evaluates that risk and determines that it's to their benefit to offer this, the purchase agreement, the standby purchase agreement.
Yes, correct. Okay. And the district's great credit, our history of being in the market essentially helps us get a lower rate for that
I have a better understanding.
Facility.
That's great.
Great question. Thank you.
So, Thomas.
Yes, sir.
When we do these, and we borrow a lot of money, and we have to do these kind of sophisticated financial transactions, and I know we have a
fantastic financial team with us. So for this transaction, it's about $24,000 to have our advisors assist us with this, correct?
Yes.
That's our fees. So could you explain to the general ratepayers out there, what are we getting for our $24,000?
We're saving about $2.5 million by renewing this agreement, as opposed to fixing out this debt and paying a higher rate for a longer period.
All right. That is something that we can explain to our ratepayers pretty succinctly, and they understand why we pay out all these fees sometimes. So appreciate the answer to that.
Move approval.
Second.
Moved by Director Record, second by Director Crona. Can I get a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Crona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Passes 5-0. Thank you, Thomas. We will go on to item B, which is to receive and
file
recycled water rate study, approve rate methodology, and set a time and place for a public hearing for the proposed calendar year 2023-2024 recycled water rates. Mr. Adams, good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly and members of the board. It is my pleasure this morning to present the final draft of the recycled water rate study and request that the board set a public hearing in June to adjust the recycled water rates. So I have a really quick presentation just to sort of summarize a couple key points. As the board is aware, the district adjusts rates on an annual basis for recycled water. In the prior budget cycle, which was in 2020 and 2021, the adjustments to recycled water were 7%. During this past budget cycle, staff recommended an overall increase of 5.8% for 2022 and 2023. During the budget process, the board expressed concerns with the proposed rate increases and ultimately adopted a 1.8% increase in year one, which was very consistent with our potable water rate increase. The board did approve a 5.8% increase in year 2023, but directed the staff to work with the planning committee to do a comprehensive rate study and return to the board prior to June 2022. So after the meeting with the planning committee, the staff ultimately engaged Corollo Engineering to perform the comprehensive rate study. The primary goals of the rate of the study was to ensure financial resiliency for the system long term, rate affordability, especially for ag customers who use approximately 2/3 of our district's recycled water, and that have been partners with the district over the past few decades, groundwater sustainability as it relates to pricing that encourages customers to use recycled water instead of pumping groundwater, and legal compliance, specifically related to the financial support of the wastewater utility and potentially the water utility. The results of the study were presented to the planning committee in March and then to the board. So here is the key recommendations from the study that were presented to the board on March 16th. As you can see on the slide, from the current market analysis that was done, ag rates were within the range of pumping groundwater, which makes sort of this groundwater sustainability and the rates affordable for ag customers, and that the five-year long-term projection only required a 3% adjustment in water in rates in order to achieve a sustainability financially for the system. Also, the wastewater transfer that the analysis showed that ultimately financial support could be up to $7.5 million by wastewater for cost avoidance and the benefits for that utility. And while currently the transfer is only $3.4 million. So really a minor increase in that transfer is well supported. And finally, that the rate recommendation for ag would remain flat for the next 2 years, and that 3% would be proposed for the other users. So this table shows the current rates for 2022, the adopted rates for 2023 based on the 5.8%, And then really the proposed new rates or recommended rates are in the red boxes. You can see ag is kept constant or flat for the next 2 years, and then adjustments on the other users by 3%. So with the proposed rate reductions in 2023, there is not a requirement to mail specific notices to users, but staff does plan an extensive outreach to stakeholders over the next 7 weeks. As you can see, PGA has a solid plan to engage stakeholders and communicate the findings and benefits of the study. Here's the remaining schedule, including today's board meeting. After the board meeting and the board approving setting the public hearing, we have 7 weeks of public outreach from April to June 15th. The public hearing would be scheduled for June 15th at 9 a.m., and if approved by the board, that reduction in rates would be implemented in January of 2023. So with that, here's the staff recommendation, which is to receive the final study and to set the public hearing for June 15th. With that, I'm available for any questions, and we do have on the phone Carollo, Alex Bugby, who did the presentation in March. Should there be any questions on the study? So with that, I'm available for any questions.
Any questions on this?
I don't have any questions. I would like to compliment staff on the whole process, because it was important to do this study, and I think for me anyway, staff brought back exactly what I was looking for. And there's a number of things that I really like about our whole system, and I think it's really a model for the state. And one of the few agencies that recycles all of our water. We have an appropriate investment in the distribution system by the sewer generator, which keeps costs at a reasonable place. And so I'll certainly move the recommendation, but I want to thank staff. And Director Cronin, too, I thought we had some excellent discussions. We didn't always agree, but that's okay. So that's part of the process.
Yeah, I'm I don't think that it really turned out the way I was looking for it to go. I will be in favor of this because it does kind of calm down the increases. I did have a couple of questions as to the, I was looking at the rate chart and kind of wanted to know what's going to happen in my division in regards to, there is no ag rate in Division 2. There's plenty of ag that could probably use reclaimed water, but it's not. It's available, but through Rancho at a substantially higher price. I was looking at the Pechanga price there, and I'm wondering if the in the Pechanga agreement with Rancho, Pechanga is going to be giving up the reclaimed water, and part of the money that is coming from the government for that Pechanga agreement is going towards reclaimed water ponds that Rancho is going to build, and then the reclaimed water that would otherwise go to Pechanga is going to go to Rancho, and how that's going to affect the pricing to Rancho, and whether or not, I mean, if I'm Pechanga and I'm basically getting very inexpensive groundwater from Rancho, I'm not buying any recycled water. So I'm wondering how, if that's been taken into consideration or so what's going to happen with that.
It's a good question, Dr. Corona. And I'll share with the board that separate from this rate study, I have had several conversations with Rancho's general manager about the recycled water rates within Rancho's service area, and specifically as it relates to our interagency agreement. As you know, we have a rate established whereby we sell recycled water to Rancho. I think it's approximately around $400 an acre foot. They mark it up for their customers. They don't have a tiered rate structure as we do for ag. And I'll share with the board that the conversation that I've had with Mr. Grantham is that we have sewer customers within Rancho. And as John just mentioned, our sewer customers do contribute to our recycled water enterprise financially. So the question I posed to Rob is, would EMWD sewer customer have access to EMWD's recycled water rate via Rancho, obviously with a markup? So he took that under advisement. He was going to go back and talk to his finance team. And if ultimately there is a path forward on that, then obviously I'd be coming back to the full board and discussing an amendment to our interagency agreement with Rancho. So that's the conversations or the discussions I've had relative to Rancho possibly revisiting their tiered rate structure as they receive water from EMWD. That's the extent of it. It's somewhat related to this rate study, but also, it's also very much separate from this rate study as well.
See, because I envision that whole Rancho California road corridor with the vineyards and a small amount of citrus that's up there, you know, potentially utilizing recycled water at some point. I get questioned about that quite a bit. When are we going to see recycled water up in our area? And I'm like, well, Rancho's got a 5,000 acre foot allotment that's going to come in the future at some point. So, you know, good luck with that. So, and the fact that being hooked up to Eastern's facilities, how many farmers in all the other divisions are hooked up to Eastern's facilities as to, you know, sewer customers? None. So we're going to make a rule down in Rancho that you have to be hooked up to the sewer system in order to get recycled water. That would eliminate virtually all of the vineyard. I mean, it's something to, you know, it's something we may want to tackle in the future, but I just think it's something we need to look at. But other than that, you know, I'm in favor of the proposal.
Well, I would like to comment about that with respect to ag at Rancho. I think the study's great and support it. Rancho used to have an ag rate, but that was solely based off of Eastern having a lower wholesale rate to Rancho for ag. And I feel like not the future ag customers, but the ag customers from the past at Rancho, just like the ag customers from the past at Eastern, took a supply of water that was hard to get rid of in the day and helped build and support an industry. And I think along those lines that maybe we should revisit whether or not we think ag that existed in the past should continue to receive some pass-through reduction from Eastern to Rancho that they would pass through to our, you know, to their recycled customers like it was in the past. I mean, it was taken away maybe, you know, 10 years ago or so. But, you know, they were the customers that were here that were taking the effluent and the, I think it was maybe even like, I mean, it wasn't the good stuff back in the day, you know, but...
Secondary.
You know, so to me, I think it's not looking at to the future, but looking to the past and saying maybe there should be some consideration for that. I just think it's hard to ask people to help support an agency. Like, I think Metropolitan did this back in the day, too, when they had a discount for agriculture. You know, they had excess water. They needed to get more revenue, and you built an industry from it, and then the water becomes more needed for you know, M&I purposes, and now you take that discount away from them. But yet they built the whole industry on it. And so to me, I feel like our ag customers here at Eastern need to have some consideration and potentially then, you know, ones at Rancho that were there supporting this and, you know, way in the past too. So that's my comment on that. But I support this. I think it's a great study and glad that the experts on the board were involved in it.
Full disclosure, Quality Turf was the one that first took the reclaimed water down in Temecula on our property. So
thank you. I would just say, you know, that's something interesting to look into. I don't think we're obligated to legally, but I think it's, you know, consideration could be given, or we could look into it at least. I think this is I like the study. I think it's really complex, and I'm happy that we went to the effort to go through the process. recognizing it's not just the cost of pumping the water out there, but there are unintended consequences if we were to increase to our aquifer, to our disposal costs, and those all have to be figured in. So I'm happy with this final outcome and recommendation.
Yeah, and I think it kind of sets the stage for more discussions about just what you guys are talking about, because to me it established the idea that it is appropriate for the people generating the sewage to participate in the cost of the ultimate disposal or use of that water. So it's great, you know, groundwork to have in place now so we can have more discussions.
Has there been a second on that? I think he made a...
Randy made the motion. Director Corona will second. My only final closing comment, appreciate the study. On the hearing date, I know we're inviting a lot of people. Let's just make sure our municipal customers are included in that, valley-wide, the school districts, et cetera. At least reach out and let them know we're doing this. So with that, may I go to roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 5-0. We will move on to item C, which is to ratify and approve the purchase order of Calgon Carbon Corporation for $282,000 for well 59 media replacement and receive and file the PFOA treatment notification limit notice. Good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. Before I get started, I'd like to introduce our carbon media representative from Calgon Carbon, Mr. Tim Brecky. Tim, if you could stand up.
Appreciate you being here today.
Thank you, Tim. All right. For this item, I'm going to go over the background, the project estimate, and then the perfluorooctanoic acid PFOA notification. As you can see from the map, Well 59 is located downstream and down gradient from March Air Force Base. In 2016, we shut down the Well 59, removed it from service because of PFOA and PFOS contamination, which the Air Force Civil Engineers Center assumed responsibility and provided reimbursement for replacement water, as well as financed the Well 59 granular activated carbon treatment plant to remove those contaminants. In 2020, EMWD and the Air Force Civil Engineers Center came to terms on reimbursement for operating costs, maintenance, and replacement of the carbon media. In late December last year, PFOA and PFOS levels within the treatment plant's lead vessels reached the conditions for changeout, which is at 35 parts per trillion, which is half the federal advisory of 70 parts per trillion. At that point, at the end of January, given that we understood that there was going to be extended lead times in receiving replacement carbon, we issued purchase order 133829 in the amount of $245,492 to Calgon Carbon to expedite that process and to prevent an extended plant shutdown. At that time, the disposal, preferred disposal method for the carbon was incineration, which was something that was preferred by the Air Force. On March 3rd, we shut down Well 59 because we received laboratory results from a February sample that showed a detection of PFOS at 3.4 parts per trillion, just below the notification level of 5.1 parts per trillion, the Division of Drinking Water's notification level, which had been reduced from 14 and 13 parts per trillion just the prior year. At the end of the month, we completed the changeout of the carbon media in the lead vessels, and through Calgon's advice, we stored the spent carbon on site until we can come to a decision on an appropriate disposal method, given that the incineration disposal method was banned by the U.S. Congress for Department of defense entities. So at that point, the preferred method was no longer available. So we're storing that carbon on site until we come to a decision on what those next steps are to dispose of that carbon. The cost to replace the carbon is $245,492 with a 15% contingency for an overall project estimate of $282,500. On March 25th, 2022, we received laboratory results from a March 1st sample at our effluent at the plant for PFOA. That result came in at 7.8 part per trillion. That was 2 days before we shut down the plant where that sample was taken, but results received 25 days later. Unfortunately, the detection above the notification level requires public notification to our board as well to our public through our annual consumer confidence report. And that notification is in your board packet. PFOA exposure over certain levels may result in cancer and toxicity to the human body. PFOA has been extensively produced in the United States since the 1940s. Although it's no longer produced in the U.S., it was produced and used in products such as carpets, clothing, cookware, firefighting foam, and such. There's still imports of PFOS into the U.S. today from outside countries that have not banned the use of PFOS. What we're doing moving forward, we're instituting additional preventative measures to ensure that we don't exceed the notification level in the future. One of the items that we are looking into is in-house testing for PFOA and PFOS to decrease the turnaround time for laboratory results. Receiving laboratory results 30 days plus is problematic for us because we're operating blindly at that point because we don't know what the levels are and what those breakthrough levels are through the carbon. In the future, we're going to enter into a multi-year agreement with Calgon Carbon to expedite the procurement of replacement carbon. Right now, Calgon Carbon's product is the only approved product for use in Well 59 because of the pilot studies that we've done several years ago to test the product and have that approved by the Division of Drinking Water. We'll be looking also at other products and doing other pilots in the future so we can expand our carbon options. But right now we're solely tied to this particular product for the removal of PFOS and PFOA. Lastly, we're looking at, in extreme case, if we have not received laboratory results within the month, before the next month, we will shut the plant down until we receive those results so we know where we're at, know that, hey, you know, we need to come up with some other options before we put the plant back in service, have that carbon changed out, or whether or not the results are still showing that we're in good standing within the treatment process. With that, the recommendation is to ratify and approve the procurement of replacement carbon with Calgon Carbon Corporation, purchase order number 133829, in the amount not to exceed $282,500, and receive and file the Well 59 PFOA treatment notification limit notice.
Very good. Do we have any questions on this?
I would just say I think we're doing the right thing, shutting it down when it, you know, even before it reaches the notification level in this case. And I drink that water, so I'm glad we're doing that. And I'd have to remind everyone that's just like you mentioned to me the other day. It's the notification level, not the maximum level.
Right. You're absolutely right, Director Sawson. So there is a response level, and obviously this level is below the response level. It is an exceedance above the notification level. And just to keep bear in mind, this is our first and only PFAS treatment system. It's been in operation for a little over a year. So as David mentioned, you know, there's opportunities here to tighten up the way we operate and maintain this facility, and we'll do that absolutely.
And I'm glad Calgon Corporation is there.
Yep. Yeah, let me say before we go to a vote, is there anything you'd like to add or mention? We do appreciate you coming and attending our board meeting.
I guess I'll
come up to the mic if you don't mind.
Yeah, I guess I'll just say that you guys are one of the first trendsetters in at least Southern California. You're one of the first operating PFAS design treatment facilities out there. And there's a lot more coming down the pipe, and we're kind of using and learning with you guys. We value Eastern as a customer, and you know, are looking forward to working with and make this a smooth process in the future.
Could you give us just a real quick snapshot of your organization, who you are, and what you do?
Sure. Calgon is one of the world leading suppliers of carbon. We manufacture vessels. We actually manufacture the carbon. And it's a domestic sourced product. So we have found through the test, I mean, just a general background, carbon is, the two main sources are coconut shells or coal, mined coal. What we found through this testing is that a coal-based product does perform the best for PFAS treatment. Not to say any product will work, it's just how long will it work, and thus what's the actual operating cost for using that material. So what was found in the testing at this site was that a reagglomerated bituminous coal-based material is the best solution, and that's what's reflected in the permit. So this is a product that we mine in the U.S. through the coal mines of, you know, Kentucky, West Virginia. So it helps insulate a little bit with the supply issues that are currently going on from an overseas product. So we have roughly over 1,200 employees in the U.S. We have facilities, two facilities here in California. I'm based local here to support Southern California and Eastern.
Perfect. Again, really appreciate you as a vendor attending our board meeting and giving us an update. So appreciate that. No further questions, or I'm sorry, Director Corona?
I have a question. You mentioned on the carbon afterwards that we now have to store it, or they don't burn it anymore, or does it go to the toxic dump at Casimir, or what happens?
That's a great question, Dr. Corona. So I think that the storage was temporary because originally we were thinking there was going to be incineration, but as David mentioned, the Air Force is funding the replacement of the media, mm-hmm. and so based on federal requirements, we decided to regenerate the media. And Tim, maybe you can comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, that's, someone comes to me and asks for a new carbon quote. Well, a big question is, what do we do with the spent material? Back when you were just doing TOC treatment or, you know, VOCs, things like that, that was easy. We could just landfill it. Or option B is we have a dedicated reactivation facility for municipal accounts. It's in Arizona. We have several in the U.S., but for the West Coast, that's what typically we would use because of trucking costs. So basically there's four options to deal with the spent material. Incineration was what the Air Force had recommended initially, which is very expensive because you can't take it, because it's used for PFAS treatment, you can't take it to any incineration facility. We would have had to truck it back to Ohio to a hazardous incineration facility, which now that's not an option. So the next option is landfilling. Now, because, and we deal with U.S. waste extensively, they've told us that the regulations for where a PFAS treatment material can be taken change daily, and it's now considered a hazardous waste. So that would have to then be taken to a hazardous waste landfill facility. The next option would be we take it back, reactivate it, and we can then put it in our pool for industrial customers. Or the other option is we could then reactivate it and store it for reuse at your facility. There's still ongoing discussions with DDW on whether or not we can use reactivated material in facilities or not. That's still ongoing. So The other wrinkle that was, you know, noticed at your facility was there was a hit back in the day on uranium found in the water. So that's even more, that's one of the reasons why we bagged it on site, was to test it to make sure that the carbon hadn't accumulated uranium over time, and thus putting it in our trucks would contaminate the trucks. And I just saw an email today that we've now tested it and we should be good to go on it. So that's again where I said, you know, that's kind of, we're all learning together on what we can do with it. The regulations keep changing, so it's definitely something that's evolving.
So when you reactivate it, what happens to the PFAS?
I mean, great question. So we, in a layman's term, will re-cook it. We bring it up to temperatures roughly about 1700 C, and it goes through a kiln furnace. At those temperatures, it takes the PFAS off of the carbon. Then it goes through afterburners at very high temperatures that break the PFAS down into its elemental forms. And you know, so we're not like just moving it around. We're actually destroying it in these furnaces. And then we'll bring it back. And there's ongoing studies with EPA to confirm that that's actually what's happening. But what I can say today is we can take the PFAS off the material and have it, the activity is then reactivated. Yes.
And the uranium too?
Probably there's no uranium on it, and that's what hope these tests are showing, so no. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for the lesson.
Do we have a motion on this item?
I'll move.
Director Slauson, seconded by Director Record. May I get a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
And that passes 5-0. Again, thank you for coming. Great piece of knowledge there. We will go to item D, which is to approve and authorize an agreement with Woodward and Curran for $104,000 for the Joint Agency Regional Water Supply Resiliency Study. Joe, you're going to do this yourself.
Yes. It'll right. Just be a quick verbal update to the board. As the board is aware, we have been engaged with our neighboring agencies, with Western, Rancho, and Elsinore, to develop a effort to look at opportunities for water supply resiliency, everything from potential participation in ocean desal or possibly even bringing ocean water to the Inland Empire as a concept. Also, regional storage, regional recycled water program, water banking, and other exchanges and opportunities. So to that end, working with the other general managers, we are going to lead this effort, meaning Eastern will go ahead and lead the contract to look at the study. And Lene and I have worked together, and we have developed a scope of work with Woodard and Curran. The cost of the study will be shared among the four agencies equally, so each participating entity will pay slightly over $26,000 for this initial study. And today we do have with us Kathleen Higgins, who's here from Woodard and Curran. As you know, Woodard and Curran is a firm that we've worked with on many planning efforts, and we're glad to see that they're able to support us with this particular project. With that, we do have another interagency workshop that will be held, I believe, on May 9th. It'll be at Elsinore Valley Municipal Water District. So I know President Pauly and Dr. Armstrong are very much part of that team, working together to look at these kind of opportunities. So what's in front of you today is the contract with Woodard and Curran, and myself, Linnea, or Kathleen will be happy to answer any questions you may have on this item.
Any questions on this item? I just want to say I'm extremely excited to have this item come forward this morning. I think it's about a year, maybe a year and a half ago, Linnea and I was sitting at I forgot what organization. It was a dinner with water people. And I started the conversation saying, we have got to start looking at some more regional inland California opportunities. I'd love to do something with some of our neighboring agencies in the Inland Empire. And I don't know if she thought I was crazy or not, but here we are a little while later actually approving this. I'm very excited for the opportunity. I don't know where this is going. I don't know what projects should come out of this, but I want to be able to tell our ratepayers that we are looking at different opportunities to increase our water footprint in the Inland Empire area.
happy to do it with some of our fellow agencies. So with that, I will move the item.
Second.
Second by Director Armstrong. May I get a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Passes 5-0. And again, thank you for attending today. Look forward to working with you on that. So thank you on that. We will move to item E, which is to approve and authorize an amendment to the agricultural lease of district property. Mr. Don Bean of Nuevo, California. Dan, good morning.
Thank you, President Pauly and members of the board. So, yes, this particular recommendation is to amend an existing agreement that was approved last year by the board for 91 acres of property that we lease here next to our Trumbull Road recycle water ponds to incorporate a much smaller 15-acre parcel that we also lease to Mr. Bean across the street. By combining these two agreements, we're realizing the benefits that we received last year when we increased our efforts to maximize the lease rate of these. The current property that we lease, the 91 acres that we're amending to add the 15 acres, was originally priced at $27 per acre. And through the efforts, you know, primarily suggestions from Directors Corona and Record, we increased that to $101 per acre. We would like to combine the 15-acre parcel that's over at the Paris Wastewater Treatment Facility with that agreement at these same rates and make those coterminous. They're closely linked together. The Paris parcel was originally much larger. It has been consolidated down to the 15 acres over years due to the implementation of our solar initiatives at the wastewater treatment facility, as well as the construction of additional recycled water ponds that we have on the southwest corner of the property. So we're talking about the 15-acre parcel. The board had approved this agreement back in March of 2020 for the 15-acre parcel. That expired in December, and during that interim period of time, staff were considering the application of spent biofilter media from our San Jacinto wastewater treatment plant, similar to what we did recently with biofilter media from the Paris facility, and utilizing that 15 acres. So we were in contact with Mr. Bean about that option of spreading the San Jacinto media. The contractor at San Jacinto ultimately discovered that there's a closer destination for that project, so that wasn't necessary, and we were able to proceed with this recommendation. As mentioned, the lease rate that we are recommending would combine with what we're receiving here at the Trumbull Road location. We would increase that to $101 per acre per year, and the term would be made coterminous. Both of those parcels would essentially expire at the same time. Mr. Bean has been the tenant at that property and actually the sole proposer. We've only received proposals from him since 2014. And has been a very, very supportive tenant in all these various initiatives that we've undertaken. So with that, we're recommending that the board approve and authorize an amendment to the lease agreement with Mr. Don Bean to add 15 acres of property located at the Paris Valley Regional Water Reclamation Facility, which he currently leases. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions on this?
Well, I'm glad that we got that extra buck. Over $101, over $100, and the additional lease money. So I'm for it. No.
Oh, second. Motion by Director Corona, second by Director Record. May I get a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 5-0. Why don't we take about an 8-minute break before we move on to the informational items? So. We could reconvene. We will move on to our informational items. Mr. Howe, would you like to do item A, which is the sale of renewable energy credits update?
Thank you, President Pauly. So we're really pleased to present this opportunity that's come available to us. With the it really maximizes the value that we're already receiving out of our solar projects, our phases 1, 2, and 3. We have, as you know, installed a substantial amount of solar energy, which not only benefits us with our energy use and our portfolio, But opportunities like this to receive additional non-operating revenue from the sale of these renewable energy credits. So first I'd like to introduce Phil Villacomez from Terra Verde, our energy consultant. He's been working very closely with Sam Robinson, our energy manager, to come up with this proposed deal. And I'll ask Sam to present the item.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the board. Did I advance it here, right? Okay. Slide one. With the completion of Phase 3 solar initiative, the district now has a total of 21.4 megawatts of anticipated capacity, which will produce roughly 47 million kilowatt hours a year. This on-site generation is expected to save about $4 million a year in utility spending. Just to give that perspective, 21.4 megawatts is enough solar to power about 4,000 houses. Go to the next slide. So renewable energy certificates, credits, what are they? One renewable energy certificate, or REC, is equivalent to 1,000 kilowatt hours of energy produced by any renewable resource, in this case solar. And we utilize Regis, an independent web-based tracking company that certifies those newly minted RECs. The district's annual production of about 30,500 RECs can be purchased by any number of entities or agencies, buyers looking to meet renewable portfolio standards. So the district's first foray into the REC market at the end of 2019 yielded positive results with the sale of about 425 a REC to Skyview Finance Company. This price was above market average at the time. We expect to realize approximately about $160,000 by the end of that three-year contract when it concludes. With our current sales initiative, we are able to secure slightly over $11.10 a renewable energy certificate, entering into a three-year contract, or currently negotiating a three-year contract with Alverde Capital Partners, valued at roughly $1 million over that three-year term. So prices for those renewable energy certificates have crept up steadily from 2015, originally valued under a dollar, and now with a more significant increase in the past few years at slightly more than $10. So there's quite a few factors driving those. I think some of the key factors are putting upward pressure on pricing. Like California, more states are implementing and imposing stringent renewable portfolio standards, initiating the purchase of those RECs. Consumer trends have also motivated companies to source and manufacture their products with an effort to reduce their greenhouse gases and reduce their carbon footprint. Current renewable technology requires a larger footprint, limiting on-site self-generation, forcing the entities to purchase RECs in lieu of generating their own renewable energy. As well, new market strategies pairing those solar renewable energy certificates with low carbon fuel standard credits, resulting in a greater value of the combined offering. So why sell now? Current timing. The marketplace is still fairly new. As it matures and finds its way, programs and requirements could change unexpectedly, resulting in less favorable returns, bringing the value of those renewable energy certificates down. Installations of renewable energy generators is growing, so that saturation will drive down that value, potentially drive down that value. And then also with advancements in new renewable technology, smaller footprints with greater outputs, greater yields, will allow for entities to install their own renewable energy sources, thus not needing to buy renewable energy certificates to offset their own greenhouse gases. So leading up to this, doing our due diligence, we did consult with the environmental regulatory compliance folks to ensure that there wasn't a greater value in retaining those RECs for future unknown future regulation, state requirements that we as a district might need to meet. And as well, with the district's efforts in their climate action plan, part of SB 32, we confirmed that those goals can be met as well without retaining those RECs. So just to recap, Terra Verde, on behalf of the district, has negotiated the sale price of $11.10 per renewable energy certificate with an estimated $1 million value for a three-year term, and we're currently working on finalizing the terms of that contract. So with that, if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Any questions on this item? Let me ask just a one, and this may not, a little maybe off topic, but what are some of the considerations as far as our footprint for additional solar? And I'm thinking specifically, if you look at that water tank on the wall there, the top of water tanks, that type of thing, is that something that we can explore in the future?
Excellent question. I think as a whole, evaluating locations like that, ponds, empty fields, locations next to facilities, absolutely everything is it's always under consideration. There's that you have to evaluate the cost of that
ROI.
Solar and the value yes. of its output at that specific facility, but definitely. Definitely.
And if I can add, you're absolutely right, President Paul. We're going to continue to look for those opportunities. As you know, we have real estate holdings that could still be utilized. We have to look at the economics of every mm-hmm. potential investment. This last phase, phase three of the solar, where we're generating approximately 16 megawatts, it's our largest phase. As you know, we did not have grant funding to help us with that, but we did have that PPA arrangement. And it's those types of mechanisms that we're going to continue to look for. With the PPA arrangement, and I recently checked with Dan and Sam on this, our cost to purchase energy from the PPA provider is fixed. There is no indexing. There is no escalation from year to year, which is unlike the Edison rates. So we were very fortunate in that we locked in those PPA rates, and we had no capital up front to install those 16 megawatts. It was all funded by the PPA provider. So it's those kind of mechanisms, financing mechanisms, that we're going to continue to look for. But absolutely, we're going to continue to look at those opportunities. And I just want to take a moment to really express my appreciation for Sam and Dan. This $1 million of revenue through the sale of the RECs is on top of the savings that we're realizing. So it's a great benefit to our ratepayers to be able to secure this, and they've done a great job doing so.
No, and I completely agree. I just think what the investments this district has made in solar and the benefits from it have been tremendous. So thank you, and I look forward to other opportunities. So,
thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll go to item B, which is per capita water use briefing. Gordon, good morning.
Morning. President Pauly, members of the board. So if we could get that presentation. All right, cool. All right, thank you. So we prepared this briefing. It's my understanding that the board had some questions for staff about this metric and, you know, how it's calculated, what kind of goes into it. And so what I want to do is I want to start with just some high-level background. So the metric that we typically use is this gallons per capita per day, GPCD, and it's a commonly used water use efficiency metric, which has the benefit of being able to normalize between service areas of different sizes by looking at usage on a per capita basis. And so it's been utilized in various pieces of state water use efficiency legislation because of that ability to make comparisons. But there's some caveats that you know are important to highlight, which is it's not always going to be an apples-to-apples comparison because of factors such as climate and also, you know, different land uses, for example, that can influence the water use efficiency in a service area. And we actually have a slide later on in this presentation where we'll highlight that a little bit more. But I mentioned that this is a metric that's often used in legislative and regulatory requirements. So some examples of that that I'm sure have come up before include the Water Conservation Act of 2009. So that's the 20 by 2020 legislation that we discussed our progress on in our urban water management plan a couple months ago. And, you know, we were able to highlight that we Eastern have met that target. Per capita use was also factored into the emergency conservation regulation back in the 2015 timeframe, although notably on that one, you know, water suppliers were tiered into different levels of required conservation based on their per capita use, but the targets were actually set based on, you know, volumetric use, so that kind of, you know, we didn't really like that. To put it mildly, and then the big piece of legislation that's being discussed now is the Making Conservation a California Way of Life legislation. So that's the requirements under SB 606 and AB 1668. And we also have a slide later on in the presentation where we'll go into more detail on that. And so in terms of the actual mechanics of this calculation, what this metric does is we look specifically at our retail service area, and we look at our supplies, excluding recycled water and, you know, what we sell to our wholesale agencies. And so in 2021, this came out to just over 86,000 acre feet, and this covers not just our residential use, but also CII. There's some potable landscape, as well as a very small amount of ag that's on potable use. And so you can see the kind of the distribution of where those supplies came from in the graph on the left. And so again, this excludes recycled water. And in terms of the denominator of this metric, the population, where that comes from is we take the most recent census data, so this would be from 2020, and we update that monthly with an estimate based on new connections. And so we kind of have this rolling estimate that we update each month of what exactly our retail service population is. And so what we do is, you know, we take that annual, you know, water supply total, you know, convert it to gallons, you know, and it's what the metric sounds like. You know, we divide that by the estimated population for the year and, you know, divide that by the number of days. And so for 2021, that came out to about 123 gallons per capita per day. And looking at this historically, we can see that our water use efficiency has been, you know, increasing over time. Under SBX 7-7, which is kind of a major baseline that we often compare against, we look at a 10-year baseline period from 1999 to 2008. And so you can see we started from a peak over that baseline period of about 212 gallons per capita per day, and the 10-year average of 197 gallons per capita per day. And you see, you know, it declined sharply in that 2009 timeframe, and you know, that comes from you know, that's around when we implemented budget-based rates, and so we saw a sharp response there. Remained relatively stable for a couple years going into about the 2015 timeframe, which is when we had the water use restrictions coming in with the last drought emergency, and so then we saw another decline there. And since then, we've remained relatively consistent in our service area. And so just comparing to the various benchmarks that we have on the screen, our 2021 value of about 123 gallons per capita per day, that's 42% below that 212 from 1999. It's 37% below the baseline that was set under SBX 7-7, and it's 30% below the target. So we definitely exceeded the target that we had to meet for 20 by 2020. So, as promised, you know, we also have a slide here comparing our water use efficiency to other major suppliers in California. And so this information comes from the Urban Water Management Plan, where, again, we were required to report under SBX 7-7. And so Eastern is highlighted in the green bar kind of in the middle. And the agencies, you know, that we're showing here that have a better, you know, water use efficiency than Eastern, they're agencies, as noted on the slide, with higher densities and cooler climates compared to EMWD. So this kind of goes back to the point that I was discussing earlier on the background slide, which is that this metric is affected by, you know, factors beyond just population and growth. There's also weather and land use factors that come into play. And just as an example, again, looking at some of the data from the urban water management plans, just as an example, the city of San Diego, one of the higher efficiency bars on this graph, their population density in terms of persons per square mile is something along the order of 4,400 persons per square mile, and their average August high is about 77 degrees. And so I want to contrast that to our service area. Our August average high is about 97 degrees, and we estimate that, you know, our retail population is about 1,500 persons per square mile, so significantly less dense, significantly hotter. And then just to bookend it, the bottom bar on this graph, Coachella Valley, their August high is 107 degrees on average, and their population density is about 360 persons per square mile. So you can see there's other factors that are in play here. Then to circle back to how per capita use factors into the Making Conservation a California Way of Life legislation. So what the state is proposing is to set objectives that are specific to each water supplier in terms of per capita use. It's going to be an efficiency-based target. The regulation states that the target needs to be more stringent than the targets that have been set under SBX 7-7. And what they're going to do is they're actually going to take an agency's water use and split it up into individual components and set targets based on that. So they are going to be setting targets for residential indoor and outdoor use, looking at water use for CII that occurs outdoors, and there's also going to be a performance standard for a water supplier's water loss. But they are excluding some uses from this objective, including the actual indoor usage of CII, customers' apparent losses, and kind of other use that doesn't fit into one of these categories. And an important point for this is that this objective is going to be enforced in aggregate. So they're not at this time looking to drill down into each of these individual water use components for every water supplier. So we could hypothetically, for example, not meet our indoor standard, but if we exceed our outdoor standard by a like amount such that we're under our total objective, then we would be in compliance. And so this graph on the right just kind of shows where our current water use lies with respect to kind of where the targets are being proposed at this time. And so the dotted line is kind of our most recent water use efficiency, and the bars are stacked are the various components in terms of what the state is kind of setting. So we're looking good for 2025. 2030, you know, we may or may not have some work to do depending on where some elements of the legislation lands. But, you know, overall, you know, we're definitely, you know, in relatively decent shape, I would say. So then I just wanted to highlight kind of some of the actions that we have taken, and will continue to take in terms of improving our water use efficiency, particularly with respect to these objectives that I just highlighted that are, you know, coming down the tracks. So as I mentioned earlier, you know, we have a budget-based rate structure, and that was, you know, we saw the benefit that had in our historic water use. So this, you know, this is a pricing structure that encourages efficient use, and it's the excessive and wasteful users that are paying for the more expensive water supplies. And so that's been very successful for us. As the board is aware, we have a very broad conservation program, you know, that ranges from device rebates and turf removal that, you know, we partner with Metropolitan on, as well as education programs and the recent Landscapes for Living program that we just rolled out. And we also wanted to highlight our accelerated retrofit program, which was a program that we started under the last drought to kind of help bring our potable water use down, because, again, recycled water is excluded from the regulations. And so this was a program where institutional customers could have their recycled water conversions paid for upfront, and where EMWD is able to recover its costs through a special rate. And so that's, you know, at this point, over, you know, 700,000 square feet of landscape has been transitioned in our service area. So that's been very beneficial to our, you know, overall water use efficiency. And so to that point, you know, we just wanted to just show one more comparison slide that looks at our per capita use over the last roughly 10 years or so. And, you know, but looking at the data, we estimate that, you know, recycled water can offset anywhere between 40 to 60 gallons per capita per day of potable demand each year. So in 2021, our per capita use would have been up to 40% higher without recycled water in our portfolio. I say up to 40% because, you know, that assumes a direct, you know, everybody who was on recycled water would take potable. Obviously, some users have access to their own private wells, but, you know, that's not a lot of them. So it's a good starting point, at least for this discussion. So, so that concludes my presentation, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
A great presentation. Go back to slide 7, please.
Yes.
So, actually, yeah. Do you think that this is the in order of what has been most important to reducing demand?
I wouldn't say it's necessarily in order. Especially in the conservation programs, that's just kind of how I organize the information, to be honest. But
well, yeah. I kind of think the rate structure made the biggest difference.
And, oh, yes, absolutely.
And the reason that I bring that up is because through this whole budget process at Metropolitan, I made the point that we cannot continue to fund conservation at the same rate without a way to pay for it when our demands have gone from over 2 million acre feet to 1.5.
Mm-hmm.
And the board doesn't want to hear that. They just so and I maintain that there are things that you can do that doesn't mean just throwing money at it. And so I really think that has had the biggest impact, and Met has a deal now where every board meeting some member agency presents about their member agency, and when Joe does that, I'm sure he's going to talk about what our demands have done, and we're going to work together on that presentation. But you know, there's nothing more irritating than a good example, and I think Eastern is full of those. I had a Monday morning group meeting yesterday with Wade Crowfoot talking about drought, and I mentioned that we have reduced our demand by 42%. So when you ask for 15% reduction, that's really hard for us to do that. And that kind of number is really, you know, an eye opener for people like that. So, you know, we've just done really well. And I appreciate this presentation because it really helps me understand, you know, exactly what GPCD is and how we get to that number. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate the presentation, and I guess I like this more objective-based approach than just cut 15 or 20% across the board to everybody. So I know it's complicated, and every agency is unique, and, you know, hitting those targets, but it seems like it's on the right, heading in the right direction, much better approach.
Yep.
I mean, I agree with Director Record. I think the rate structure of telling people that wasting water costs you a lot of money, that's a very, very simple concept that most people get, is the most important thing we can do. And so I think you can show people all sorts of ways to conserve water, and that's very helpful. But at the end of the day, I think it's a money, a dollars and cents issue that really gets to people. But proud of what this district has done over the last decade plus of, I think that statistic that I used speaking to a group the other day, that we're using the same amount of imported water that we used in 1990, is just eye-opening, that we have doubled our population and we haven't imported any more water into the area. And that's because this particular district, and I'm again, give Director Record a lot of credit, made all the necessary adjustments to using recycled, et cetera, that we're able to do that. And I do agree, when I hear people in Sacramento wanting to micromanage what we're doing here, it kind of turns me a little, it bothers me a little bit. I think sometimes maybe we should be showing other districts around the state what we have done and give them some ideas. But that's my political commentary for the day.
Anybody else on this item?
Great job, Gordon. Thank you for the information.
Thank you.
We will go to item six, which is to receive and file various reports. Do I have a motion for that?
Move it.
Director Record moved it. Director Slauson seconded it. If I get a roll call vote, please.
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Kroner?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
And that passes 5-0. We will now go to our calendar. Jennifer, good morning.
Good morning, Director Pauly and members of the board. I have two events in your calendar packet to bring to your attention. One, the first one is the Riverside County Water Task Force. I did send an email out and got response on that, but just wanted to make sure everybody had the flyer. It is this Friday at 7:30 in the morning. It is a virtual event that will cover drier by the day. So the second event is the press release from Water Reuse. It's a save the date for their annual California conference. That is scheduled in September, the 11th through the 13th, and will be in person in San Francisco. So on page 2 and 3 of the packet is a kind of lengthy board master calendar just because of the time difference between board meetings. So please take your time and review that information and let me know if you have any changes to your items. On page 4 is the upcoming the upcoming conferences and events with the participants. So we do have this Friday the Southern California Water Coalition luncheon that will be held at Wilson Creek. The first week of May is the Aqua Spring Conference along with CS Week in Phoenix. And then we also have in May the State of the City addresses for the City of Temecula and the City of Paris. And then rounding out the third month there is going to be in June is the WRCOG General Assembly, which all of these events still have availability. If anybody is interested, please contact me. So, on continuing on page 4 is the upcoming board and committee meetings. As stated, the next board meeting will be Wednesday, May 18th. Additionally, we've rescheduled the retirement committee. That is moved to Wednesday, June 1st. And then also noted the administrative committee did move to Tuesday, May 10th. Other than that, all other meetings are on schedule. And then on page 5 is the list of interagency meetings from May to July, in which they are all still on schedule. And that concludes my report.
Any questions for Jennifer? All right. Thank you very much. We will go to Director's attendance reports, and we can start with Director Armstrong.
We had the Eastern Elsinore interagency meeting, and that was good as usual, and a lot of discussion about MET and MET's rates and what was going to happen, and so now we know. But that was a good meeting. Temecula Valley Chamber Legislative Summit says a legislative summit, but it was the county sheriff, the county district attorney, and police chief from the city of Marietta really giving us an update on what's happening in our county. It was really, really informative and educational, and I think it was good that we participated in that. City of Menifee Spring Festival, that was the event where we had our hydration station and some of our staff out there, so I just stopped by to say hi and watch all the young kids just go crazy for those Easter eggs when they said go. It was like, it was pretty fun. So that was good that we were there. I did have a phone call with the auditors yesterday on the Standard 99 interview, and then the Menifee Masters meeting is a program that the city of Menifee puts on, and they educate community stakeholders on the city. All the different utilities come in, and Amanda Fine went and made a presentation on Eastern, and just did a incredible job. Really, really great overview. She did get one question though that I wanted to bring up was someone asked about COVID testing in wastewater. And if that was something that we're doing, or we would be doing, because you know there's been some press about about testing that. So she actually fields all the questions really, really well. I didn't know the answer, but she said we would if we were asked to, but I didn't know if it was something that we have been asked to do or if it's something that we...
And Matt, can I elaborate? But we currently are not conducting that testing. Matt, I don't know if you want to add that.
Yeah, we actually looked into it quite a bit when the pandemic started. But ultimately, it just kind of gives a general trend in your area of infections increasing or decreasing. And, you know, we could do the samples. We could, you know, go through considerable expense to do that. But ultimately, if no one's consuming the data, it's kind of lost anyway. So, I mean, if the county was asking for us to do this to help them manage the pandemic, you know, perhaps we could look into it. But, you know, so far we had decided not.
That's the right meeting.
All right. Very good. Just a note, I love hearing about the water van at these public events. I think that is probably one of our better tools that we collectively have come up with for sharing the goodwill of the district. So, Director Corona?
Yeah, Jeff covered the Elsinore meeting. I attended the Rancho meeting, pretty short meeting. They had one action item on basically on the emergency extensions. So that's all I have.
Very good. I did not get a chance to attend the Southern California Water Coalition Executive Committee meeting. Marietta Lions Club asked me to be a guest speaker at their meeting on water issues. I was happy to do it. About 35 people at their meeting. Again, always surprised with community groups that the questions you get, they really do understand. I often wonder if people are paying attention to drought and the water conditions, and it's amazing. When you speak to a public group, is some of the good feedback and questions you get. Always a good meeting with the general manager on various subjects. WRCOG planning for the General Assembly. I was asked to, myself and Director Denstedt, as the two water representatives, what we want to be sharing. The theme of this, I believe it's June 23rd. Steve Wozniak, the co-founder of Apple, is going to be the guest speaker, but the theme is kind of technology, and so we're talking about what can we showcase in water technology-wise, and I suggested, I think, our new expanded desal operation, and so we'll probably do a video on that at some point before the dinner. Winchester Municipal Advisory Committee, the County Planning people were out to talk about Winchester, the general plan. A lot of feedback there about this. As you know, there's a lot of new housing going in the Winchester area, and people asking if they hear drought and they see new houses coming up. So I always like to talk about the water resiliency and how we're able to provide the good quality water service and expanding population because of the things we do at Eastern. So we're good, and then a good meeting with April on outreach activities. So that's my report. Director Record.
Standing committee meetings that met March 22nd. We did adopt the IRP after a longer than 2-year struggle with that. So just in time to start the next one. Meeting with General Manager March 23rd, always good to have dialogue about what's going on. Had a Met Special Board of Directors meeting on March 29th for various issues. I did not make the Joint Inland Orange County Caucus April 7th, and then Standing Committee and Board meetings April 11th, 12th. The biggest issue was the budget and getting that approved. There was also a vote on continuing to fund planning for Sites Reservoir, which was very contentious, but did end up passing, which I was pleased that it did. Eastern meetings, I did not attend the Rancho California Ad Hoc Committee, and then again, monthly update with General Manager so on April 14th.
All right, very good. Director Slauson?
Yes, I attended the meeting with Joe. Joe Mawad, and that was just, we went over a lot of the agenda items and just other upcoming events and issues facing the district. Attended SAPI yesterday. We approved hired an auditor, and we agreed to write a letter of support for a resolution to protect ratepayers, water and sewer districts and the ratepayers from PFAS liability. Which, who was doing the resolution? Orange County? Yes. Orange County. So that's it.
All right, very good. Do we have director's comments or future agenda items?
I have some comments.
The record?
I mentioned that Monday morning group met yesterday virtually with Secretary Crowfoot. Over the last 4 to 6 weeks, we've had meetings with DWR Director Nemeth, State Board Chair Escoval, John Laird, and without exception, they all understand Eastern and are very complimentary about what we do and how advanced we are, especially in conservation. So I just want to, you know, make people aware of that and thank staff for that effort, and want to really recognize people like Danielle, who has really gone overboard and has taken a lot of heat over the last year. And I just really appreciate her efforts, and hopefully I'm sure she gets the support that she needs, but I want to just bring that up. And I think one of the great things about working at Eastern is that you get to play on this level, which not a lot of agencies do, and it didn't happen overnight. It's been in the works for decades. So I just want to take a moment and say that I'm really proud of this district and where we're at and what we get to be involved with and how we get to work on things that really have an impact on the future of water, which is couldn't be more important right now. And the other thing I just want to ask about is, I know that we're working hard in a lot of different directions, but I want to know if there's something that we're going to bring forward in the near future that says, okay, here's what we have to do in the face of this drought, to whether it's talking about outdoor irrigation or whatever. I think it's important that we have something tangible that we can point to and say, okay, we hear you, here's what we're doing. So,
to that point, Dr. Record, yes, we are working with our team to identify a number of additional investments and actions that we can potentially make, knowing that we're going to be in this drought condition at least this year. So one of those things that we are working on is we are working with UC Riverside to do an analysis on a concept for non-functional turf management within our service area, essentially very similar to the accelerated retrofit program on the recycled waterfront, where potentially, we're going to have to see where UCR comes in terms of their independent review of this concept, but we would front the cost and do on-bill financing to remove non-functional turf. So it's a concept at this point. We're working with a professor, Dr. Kurt Schwabe, to do that analysis to understand the economics. But that's just one of several things that I'm working with Jolene and Danielle on. But absolutely, we are looking at everything we can do, knowing that there will be more severe drought conditions coming our way.
Thank you.
I did have one thing. I was just going to recognize Nick because he's sort of the liaison with SAPA for me, so I was able to reach out with him, just kind of get direction on some of the issues that were facing yesterday.
Director Armstrong.
Just to tag on to Director Record about what we're doing, one of the things that I think would be helpful is in our outreach is, because our budget-based shared rates are so critical to our drought efforts, is they have to be maintained. And I think it would be a good gesture on our part to have outreach that asks our customers, reminds our customers, take a look at your factors that you have for your water budget, your landscaper, your number of people in the home, and remind them now before we get into a point in time that we might have to rely on those even greater to contact us and make sure that we got them right, because that's what's important, is that they're right. And you have people change homes, things happen, and it's a maintenance thing, but I think it would be a good gesture on our part to do an outreach before before you get to summer on it, or include it in some outreach that we're doing.
That's a great suggestion, Dr. Armstrong. And just thinking out loud here, a little over 80% of our customers stay within their water budgets. But to your point, there is 18 to 19% who on occasion will exceed their budget. So I think having targeted outreach to those customers who exceed their budget, I think that would be beneficial. So I'll work with April. And we'll work on that, absolutely.
All right. With that, legal counsel, is there a need for a closed session today?
Yes, there are, Mr. John. As identified, item 9, A, B, and C on today's agenda.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Are we going to do closed session in here? Okay. Let's take about 2 or 3 minutes and change over to closed session then. All right. Can we tell me when we're back on? We're ready to go. We're back in open session for the April 20th board meeting of Eastern Municipal Water District Board of Directors. May I get legal counsel to give us a report out of closed session?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pursuant to Government Code Section 54957A, the board met to discuss public services, threat to public services and facilities. A discussion was had by the board and instruction and authority was given to staff. The board also met pursuant to Government Code Section 54956.9 to discuss one item of potential litigation. Instruction and authority was given to staff. And lastly, the board received a report on existing litigation pursuant to Government Code Section 54956.9, San Diego County Water Authority versus Metropolitan Water District. A report was given to the board. No formal action was taken on that matter. That concludes the closed session report.
Very good. With that, we will stay adjourned until May 18th, 2022. Thank you all.
All right. See you.